Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Deb Friday, from the Friday Night Beginners Meeting in Doylestown.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa. Okay. I'm ready. Hi, I'm Deb. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Jenny, for inviting me here tonight. It's an honor to be here and to be speaking in front of a group of my friends and my family. And again, I'm Deborah. I'm an alcoholic, and my sober date is sobriety date is March 4th, 2009. And it wasn't the first time that I came around. I hope it's my last date. I think it's a good one, so I'd like to keep it. You know, I think when I think about what I've done this time from what I did before, first time I came around, I can definitely say that I had an experience of surrender that was complete, and I would say that it's something that I attend to continuously. Surrender to, you know, my powerlessness over this disease and over all circumstances in my life, because I have power over nothing today, and except for how I react and my relationship with my higher power. And I truly believe that, but I have to remind myself of that on a daily basis. Let's see what it was like. I was raised in a great family. You know, I know that circumstances don't dictate me being an alcoholic because I have no excuse. My family, my parents were from the Midwest. They had good, you know, Midwestern values, hard work, you know, believing and sort of like pulling yourself up from your bootstraps and you know, work hard, play hard. And I think that was kind of their philosophy. I was the last of four children, and I was a pretty bright kid. I never had any problems in school for some time, and I did pretty well at pretty much everything I set my mind to. I can say that I was blessed. I was a good athlete. I had lots of friends and a supportive family that provided all my needs. I think I never really questioned myself. I had a little bit of an insecurity issue, but I think when we moved from Connecticut to Pennsylvania, I was 14 years old and really had never questioned who I was. And I started to question who I was and what I stood for at the ripe old age of 14. You know, I realized that I wasn't really very cool. And I realized that early on. I remember asking someone if there was a Girl Scout troop in the area. I was kind of perplexed at the response, and then I kind of let that go, and I decided I was going to drop that. And I was a seeker, you know. From early on, I was looking for God. You know, we were raised in the Episcopal Church, which I've heard referred to as Catholic light, but I don't really like that. But it comes into play later in my story. I actually, when we moved to Pennsylvania, I started to lose myself a little bit. Like I said, it was, you know, the process of making friends, being new, being in band, as well as playing sports. But being a smart kid, you know, I had some, you know, issues with a group of boys picking on me and throwing gum in my hair, and it was like ongoing, and you know, just harassing, you know, and I didn't really say anything. I kind of kept it myself and would just turn beet red and deal with it. So I think when I started, my older siblings had all been kind of partiers. My oldest brother was, you know, born in the 80s and, or not born in the 80s. He was, that'd be nice. He was, sort of living in the 80s, you know, like the Wall Street cocaine addiction thing. And, I had seen him go through some trouble. So I had actually, like I said, sort of, I was kind of a goody two shoes and I had sworn off all alcohol. And, it wasn't till I was, I would say either late 14 or early 15 when I took my first drink of alcohol, and I didn't really have that feeling of that everyone talks about, this moment where, you know, I had arrived, and I just noticed that I could talk to people a little bit easier, and I could be with people a little easier, and my parents would travel a lot, and I would invite people to my house, and they would bring booze, and so I started to become a little bit more liked, and I didn't even really drink that hard at that point. You know, I think I kind of tried to keep things under control. You know, I guess I started to black out around 17. I started to drink harder, and at the same time, and I always have this sort of like, you know, the all or nothing kind of personality, and I was still kind of looking for God. You know, I had tried the Mormon church, and I tried the Baptist church, and I thought, you know, this is what's wrong. This is what is going on. I need to be in the right group, you know. But at the same time, when I would go to school, I would, you know, try to seek out my friends and whatever, you know. I wanted to be liked, you know, and it hasn't changed. Like I said, I started to black out, you know, around 17, I had managed to do very well in school. I went to college, and of course, you know, it got worse. Within actually the week before school started, I was there for an orientation, and I had I was in an incident where, you know, it was considered rape, and didn't remember. So I had people asking me, you know, what happened, and I had no recollection of it. From that time forward, I would say I pretty much drank to get annihilated, and I liked the way that I was received. You know, I played basketball. I bet you didn't guess that. you know, my nickname was Wild Thing. And, you know, at the time, I felt like that's what I could offer. I went to a very prestigious and competitive school, and the girls were all gorgeous and thin and smart and motivated. And then I felt like there was me, you know. So what could I bring to the table? I could bring this. I could bring this ability. And at the time, I felt like I could really drink. Now, I had already been to see a drug and alcohol counselor. I had already, you know, gotten in trouble with security on campus, and I had already seen my grade slide like I'd never seen before. And then I knew at 18 that I had no control over my drinking. And I just continued to do it because I felt so terrible about not knowing what happened, about asking people what happened, about reading it in a newsletter that the social group put out, you know. Oh, is that what happened? Okay. You know, and I pretty much went through my college years just blacked out. I had no skills I had no social skills, and it was everything to me. I think it was my identity, you know. And as long as they, you know, thought I was, as long as I was considered Wild Thing, it was okay, you know. I failed a class my senior year. I started to lie to teachers. I tried to manipulate the system. I did graduate, and barely. I saw kids go on, my peers go on to law school and medical school and do a lot of amazing things. I had no idea what I was going to do. I had started to lose myself, really. You know, I had, since the time I was 14 years old, I lost that confidence. I lost that feeling that, you know, I was one of God's children. I went overseas because I realized that was sort of the, that would shut people up, that I could live overseas. No one would know how I was drinking. No one would know how I was eating. At the time, I had an eating disorder as well. And I could kind of just disappear. And that's the way I liked it. I didn't have to talk to anybody, no one on the phone, because at the time they couldn't figure out how to call me because of all those numbers. And so I pretty much was alone. And it was a great excuse to drink a lot. And also, I was working for a think tank, so I thought, on the outside, it looks really good. And no one's going to question what I'm doing. At the same time, I was, you know, just spiraling. I had no clue what I was doing, what I was supposed to be doing. I had no sense of self. I was just wandering, lost, you know, is all I can say. And it happened to be overseas. And I know that I understand the phrase when they say, wherever I go, there I am, you know, because from Brussels in Belgium, I moved to Poland. And I worked over there for another 2 years. And I had a lot of homemade vodka and a lot of cheap beer. And I did a lot of traveling, which was fun. I had a lot of really, really bad stuff happen. But nobody knew about it. You know, so it was okay. And I think, you know, it was my escape for sure, my solution to everything. You know, my drinking career continued and just definitely got worse when I came back to the United States. I tried to have a career. That didn't work. I initially, you know, the first time I got fired, it was sort of a like, let's part on, you know, let's both agree to disagree and you go your way. This didn't work out. And it was like, yeah, this didn't work out. You know, I was doing things in their office after hours. It wasn't good. The second time I got fired, I got pulled in by HR and, you know, sat down and you're forging company documents, da-da-da-da, and I was like, ah, I just clocked out early and went to drink. I mean, that's not really bad, right? But the way they worded it made it sound so bad, you know. And, you know, the next time I got fired, I just walked out. Because that's how I did it eventually. I left the job preemptively, figuring we don't have to have that awkward conversation. I'll call you or I won't, but I'm probably not coming back. And, you know, like I said, I was a very good student. And that was one of the things that I really prided myself on. You know, I definitely interviewed well, and, you know, usually within 3 weeks or so, I kind of lost steam, you know, couldn't make it to work, et cetera. I ended up in Philly in an apartment on a mattress with cockroaches all around me. I had been in jail a few times, much to my surprise. And I could tell you why, and it's not my fault, because it was always them, you know. And I always had a good reason for doing what I was doing. I started to get really down. I started to see a psychiatrist. I got prescribed pills because I had anxiety and depression, and I started I dated a man that contributed definitely in terms of making it easier for me to get what I wanted to get when I was drinking, and making it easier to loathe myself because of the activities that we were involved in. And again, you know, I sort of went from like white to black, and I couldn't find that in between stage. I had actually converted to Catholicism when I got back from Poland, because I felt like this is what's going to do it. You know, it wasn't Episcopal, it wasn't Mormon, it wasn't Baptist, it wasn't Judaism. Maybe it's because I need to be Catholic and I need to convert. I mean, I need to confess, and it'll all be better. And so I did. I went through 9 months of RCIA, and I think I was the only person there that didn't have a spouse for the reason why they were converting. And I was combative and miserable the whole time, listening to kind of the rules and thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to go to hell really quickly. And I don't know if I can stomach this. So, you know, what happened was the priest that took me through from Doylestown, he and I were very close. He was Slovakian, and so we would speak Polish and Slovakian, very similar. And he died. And I felt like he was really my only connection to that church. I, of course, didn't stop drinking and using that whole time. So there's no connection as long as we're still using. But I never made that connection. And interestingly enough, that priest was very involved in AA and took prisons and, took meetings into the prison, and probably could have helped me out a lot if I had ever really truly gotten honest. I continued down that rabbit hole for a while, just getting more and more miserable. I tried to take my own life, I would take whatever just to get out of my head, you know. And I definitely relate to the garbage pail phrase, because, or the garbage head or whatever it is. I felt like I would take whatever pill you had, whatever powder you had in front of you, any drink, every drink, just to stop my head. I also had always been interested in yoga, and I was trying to become a yoga teacher, but I was always hungover or still high when I tried to go to my training. And I lost my job. I told her I wasn't going to be able to pay. The woman was kind enough to offer me to write for her. If she had a website, and if I could blog for her, I could stay in the program. I couldn't even do that. I was talking about really dark and terrible things, because that's where I was, you know. So I would talk about solitude and the importance of, you know, whatever. But she was like, I can't put this on the website, you know. Can you cheer it up a little bit? And I couldn't. And you know, I ended up getting kicked out. That was the one thing that was my new conversion, you know. I was going to become a yogi. It was the thing I felt most passionately about. And I couldn't even do that. you know, I got to a point where, you know, every day I was not going to drink, but certainly on Mondays. And my last run started on a Monday when I wasn't going to drink. And I would get out of the bar in just enough time to make it to the liquor store. And just enough time, and once I had my liquor, I would go back to the bar. But I would stumble home, and I was living with a family because I felt like I surely won't drink when there's a six-year-old. I would just set off their alarm and lose my keys and break into the window, and I was a terrible tenant, and, you know, that didn't work either. And through all this time, you know, I really honestly just felt like I was deeply depressed and a little bit paranoid. I couldn't go outside without smoking a joint, and that's just the way it was. But it had nothing to do with how much I was drinking. You know, I finally got to the point, like I said, this last run, I had woken up in a place I didn't know. I was sober, and I didn't leave, you know. I couldn't remember who I was with. I didn't really care. And I finally just called out and said I was going to check myself in to Pennsylvania Hospital and the psych ward, and I didn't. I ended up, you know, trying to kill myself and taking a whole bunch of pills and calling people and, again, scaring them and just not caring. And when I woke up, I decided I couldn't continue living like this, and I had no idea where the instruction book was for this thing called life, because I had just, like, gone off the cliff, man, and was tumbling down so fast that I had to take myself out of this. I went to my psychiatrist, and she suggested that I had a drinking problem, that I might be an alcoholic, and I agreed. And I went to a rehab, and after that I went to an aftercare program, I went into a recovery house, I did everything they told me to, and for the first time in my life I had hope, and I was getting explicit instructions of what to do, and I did everything that I was asked to do. The first time I went through the steps was through the 12 and 12, and like I said, I don't think I had a complete surrender. I had made some really poor choices early on. They actually, you know, I was the house mother, and they took it away from me, and there was always drama, you know, the girls from the recovery house know how that is. You know, they thought I was on drugs because of the choices that I was taking, making. I think about that now, and I was so indignant, you know, because I was sober and clean. But that's how I am without a God. And so I was kind of going through the motions, and I was drinking Listerine out of the cabinet, truth be told, but I was taking my coin. And it wasn't until I moved back to Pennsylvania, and I had some really scary things. I was trying to claim that I was still sober, but I was relapsing and on pills and drinking Listerine because I wasn't drinking, and I had a back problem. And it was very quick that I realized I couldn't keep that up, and I told on myself. And that was the best thing I could do, because I had all these secrets, you know, secrets of stuff that had happened to me and things that I did and things that I was never going to tell anyone. And I realized, like, where that got me was really sick and just miserable and drinking because I just needed to shut my head off. I heard a woman in Doylestown, and you know Doylestown gets a lot of grief, but there are some an army of women that and men who use the Big Book, and I heard her speak, and she had just a light in her eyes, and she just seemed like she seemed like an angel. I went up to her and I asked her to sponsor me, and I told her everything, you know, and we quickly went through the steps, and you know, I was scared to death to start working with newcomers, but I was told that that was the only way I could ensure my sobriety, and so I started to do it blindly. I also started to do things that I'd always wanted to do. You know, I went down and lived on an ashram in Virginia, and I got my yoga teacher training, my yoga certification. I learned to meditate down there, and I had a spiritual experience. And I had an experience where I knew that God was with me, and I knew that God is love, you know, and it was an experience like no other, like nothing I've ever done, where all I could feel was warmth and joy and gratitude. And, you know, in the middle of a meditation, the tears are running down my cheeks, and I realized at that moment that I don't really need a church to have God in my life and to have a relationship with God, because God, I believe, is within us all along, you know. And we always talk about kind of removing, and I do, I think about it like that all the cobwebs and the dust and the paint and the, you know, rustiness and just all the stuff that's within us, and just we're just kind of working it away and removing it, and you know, somewhere within us, there's a brilliant light that's waiting to shine, you know. And I believe that I finally kind of tapped into that, you know, and I had an experience or a realization or a recognition or an awakening or whatever you want to call it. And it fired me up, you know. I wanted more of it, of course. So I you know, I started to meditate and talk about meditation, and life got kind of lifey, but you know, through it all, I had these women that I was trying to help, and you know, I can honestly say that being able to help another woman in recovery has been truly the bright spot of my life, and continues to be, because I see God come into their eyes, and I see women become grateful again, and I see women realize, you know, that they are already exactly who they're supposed to be, and it's just about keeping that connection with their higher power to maintain that. I got married to another person in AA, and that was something that I thought I was never going to do, because two of us together is crazy. You know, I've learned a lot from this person and from my husband, and you know, he continues to teach me. We've had some tough times right before I got married, specifically right before we got married, and you know, I was freaked out and all about self and self-centered to the extreme and filled with fear. And my sponsor told me to find someone to work with. And I did that. And wow, that worked. And, you know, that's what I've found truly, is that whenever I get to those hard places, those hard spaces, those times when I've lost my connection to my higher power, I just have to find someone to help, and I have these moments of reprieve, you know, these moments of relief, and this moment where I'm connected again with my higher power. And, you know, that was my experience then, and it continues to be. You know, we've had some struggles, and without going into it, I got back into self and self-centeredness and self-pity and anger. And again, you know, I'm once again looking to work with a newcomer. You know, I'm kind of at a place where we were talking about this earlier. You know, a lot of my sponsees are at a good place in helping other women, and that's exactly where they need to be, and that's awesome, you know, and it's so amazing to be a part of that. But, you know, I know that for me, when I get into this space, when I get into this place in my head, when I get full of fear that, you know, this life isn't going to work out the way I'm trying to manage it to, I have to remind myself that, you know, I'm not running the show, that all I have to do is pause and ask God to remove the fear, and serenity follows, you know. I've gotten a lot of beautiful gifts from sobriety. Aside my partner and best friend, you know, I've got a career for the first time in my life. I'm actually in a career where I didn't think I could be, because I had a record, and you know, God worked mysteriously and beautifully, and someone fought for me to get into this internship, and it's awesome because it's all about being able to be present in your body and present in the moment, and realizing that what you eat can make you well or make you sick. And so I'm really excited to kind of undertake this new chapter in my life. You know, I am active in a church, and I'm very active in a church. I don't think I always feel God in a church, but I like the opportunity to be of service, and I like that family too. You know, AA feels like a closer family. Church sort of feels like, you know, the in-laws. but, you know, I can't quite be myself. But it's cool, you know. And, you know, I just think it's so ironic that, you know, I searched up and down and, you know, all around in every church and every, you know, in yoga and everywhere. And, you know, I had definitely converted to alcoholism. I looked everywhere. You know, they say spiritus contra spiritum, and, you know, one spirit against the other. And for me, that was totally my experience. You know, once I realized that, you know, God is love, and God is within us, and I am no different than anyone else. I really, truly believe that when you have that tolerance, when I've had that tolerance and feeling of love and compassion for everyone else, it's changed my life. I don't get self-righteous. I do, but I don't, you know, and I don't have a right to be, I don't have a right to self, you know, justified anger. And I realize that everyone is trying their best on any given day, you know, and I try to go through life with that. I think, you know, one of the big things for me has been continuous faith in God. And I think lately, you know, I've come closer to, you know, we always are walking toward or walking away from a drink, and I feel like I've walked more towards the other end recently than any other time in my life. I realized that alcoholism is not about, you know, the unmanageability of me over the drink, because I don't feel like drinking. I just sometimes, when I get into that place of self, I just want to run away, you know. That was always my go-to. I'm going to move, you know. And so for me to stick and stay sober, I personally feel is a huge growth for me. I think, you know, these scary times when you feel like you've done everything right, but God has a different plan, it's really, it's shaken me up a little bit. But I'm an alcoholic. I know that I need to stay, and I know that I need to help somebody else. Self-centered, you know, self-centered to the extreme. Selfishness is at the root of our problems, and that's exactly what's going on. You know, my mind, my ego's taken over, and even standing here in front of you, you know, I have a hard time with speaker meetings. I have a hard time with speaking because I always feel like it gets us back to that terminal uniqueness, you know, that was a big part of my problem from the very beginning. Don't you know how different I am than you, you know? It poured AA. I wasn't going to go to AA. AA was for losers. And don't you know who I am, you know? And now, thank God, you know, I'm just another alcoholic. And I'm here. And so it's... But, you know, it's hard. It's hard, you know, hearing your story and not getting into that ego and thinking, oh, this is how I'm different, you know. But this is how, you know, one story is my story, is your story, is his story. Like, that, it's that, you know, the feeling of emptiness and despair, you know, the feeling of desperation. And I believe the deep longing for God that it talks about in We Agnostics, you know, that really we all share. I have a lot of time left. You know, the steps have definitely been my solution. And I continue to redo them every single day. I recently did another fourth step with my sponsor, it was a fourth step like they do in Back to Basics, where you're looking at your assets and you're looking at your liabilities. And that's not how I do it with my sponsees, but that's how she did it with me. And so that was good. That was good. And I could see, you know, selfishness, jealousy, envy, all of these things coming out with another sponsee, believe it or not. And this sponsee I'd been out with, and I'd known her for many, many years, and I actually went to make an amends to her, and that's how she became my sponsee. So, you know, God works in amazing ways. But, you know, I've had some problems recently trying to separate, you know, ego, selfish Deb that was out with this woman, and sponsor Deb, and the lines were very blurred. So, you know, I use these steps just in my daily life to kind of address anything that comes up, and I believe truly, truly that these are it's a spiritual solution. I always have to look at my part, and I always have to, you know, look for how God is asking me to work in life today, because it's not always what I expect it to be. I guess, you know, I will end early. But I, you know, have an opportunity to share my thoughts, and I appreciate it. You know, I do believe in the big book, but I also believe that it's not the only path, you know. And I think that, you know, coming into the room, this is my opinion, but part of what worked for me was to realize that I'm not unique and to feel that sense of community and that unity. And what I see happen a lot with Big Book Thumpers versus, you know, other people, just don't drink and make a meeting, is this, like, divisiveness, you know? And it's, I think, confusing to the newcomer, and I think it's very scary for the future of our program, you know? I definitely wish that everyone had was actually working a program and had a higher power and was doing an 11-step review and was doing the 10-step during the day and making amends continuously and talking about making amends. But that's not the case. And I have to be tolerant of them as well. I have to come from a place of love with every single person in this room and pray for those who are still spiritually sick and help them if I can. And I do talk about the big book, but damn, it's tiring sometimes. you know, just it's fighting a battle sometimes, you know? And I applaud everyone here who continues to talk about, you know, set up big book workshops and seminars. And I've been to a lot of them. I've been to Bill Wilson's house many, many times up in Vermont. And I love that stuff, you know. But in the end, you know, taking the big book, taking the steps and using the big book to help someone else is what's going to ultimately keep me sober and keep me free. You know, I met Jenny from a prison commitment, and for a while I was doing a lot of those. And I can say that left me feeling more grateful than going to a meeting, for sure, going to a regular meeting. I actually, we were talking about the roundup on the way up. I was at the roundup a couple years ago, and a woman came up to me and said, you know, do you remember me from Bucks? And at the time, I was going to Bucks County Community College, and I said, I thought she meant that. And so I was like, yeah, you know. And she ended up being on the God As I See It panel at the end of the roundup on Sunday morning. And she said that that woman there, and she pointed to me, came into the prison and, you know, brought a meeting into the prison. And I believe that's why I'm here today, you know. And it was one of those moments where I was like, oh, my God, you know. It's just, I mean, I don't know, you know, that's God, you know. There's so much of God here. There's so much of God in this room. And sometimes we just have to shut up and listen, you know. You know, I'm so grateful to be sober today. Life continues to present challenges, and I continue to remind myself that I'm not in charge today and that I have a new director, and continue to use meditation on a daily basis, and I continue to look to help someone else, you know, in AA, out of AA. It's not always perfect. And it's often, most often not, and sometimes very, very flawed. But I think as long as I continue to follow the guidance outlined in the big book. And you know what? Listen to my intuition, because the program has blessed me with the ability to have my intuition more aligned with God than ever it was in any church that I was in when I was drinking. You know, it's just, I know what the right thing is today, you know, and I feel like sometimes it's scary, but when you actually take that action, when I take that action to do the right thing, it's not always that immediate, like, oh my God, that was amazing, you know, but it's often just a quiet sense of satisfaction, you know, a quiet sense of, you know, everything aligned in the right way that it was supposed to. And I know that that was God directed, you know. And so, you know, I look for ways to, you know, hear God in my daily meditations and daily reflections. And I can do that today because I have the clarity and the mental focus that can only come when I'm sober. I can only hear God's voice when I'm sober. And so often it comes to me in the rooms, you know, more times than not. And this is, you know, easily the most important thing I've ever done. And will always be at the center of my life, no matter how harried things get. You know, the guy, this was Saturday night, was talking about this is, you know, it can't just be another spoke in our daily life. Like, it has to be the center, has to be the cog. And I can definitely relate to that. It's not, when I found out the news last week that, you know, I might not be able to have children, which was my dream, you know, we went to a meeting, and we picked a couple people up and went to a meeting. And my mom said to me, "Don't you think you need to do something for yourself?" And I said, "I am," you know. And that's what this is about, you know. So it's a journey, and it's perfectly imperfect, and I'm just so grateful to be here and to be able to speak and share my thoughts such as they are. And I just love you guys, and I'll pray for you all. Thank you.